Kurt couldn't be with us today, and he asked me if I would deliver the Tay Show. So, for those who might not know me, my name is Gary. I hope you're not disappointed that Kurt's not here, and I hope I'm not disappointed. Today's Tay Show will be on Case 29 and the Hekigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record. Daizuiz, It Will Be Gone With the Other. Engo's Introduction. Fish swimming, the water is disturbed. A bird flying, a feather falls. Host and guest are clearly distinguished. Black and white are sharply divided. It is like a clear mirror on the stand and a bright jewel in the hand. When a man of Han appears, he is reflected. If a man of Ho comes, he is mirrored. Sound is manifest, color is apparent. How will it be like that? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Daizui, when the kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it perish or will it not perish? Zui said, it will perish. The monk said, then will it be gone with the other? Zui said, it will be gone with the other. Secho's verse. Blocked by the double barrier, the monk asked from the heart of the kalpa fire, wonderful words, it will be gone with the other. Thousands of miles he wandered in vain, seeking a master. Well, when Kurt asked me to give this Tay Show and I realized it was New Year's Eve, I thought, well, it'd be nice, I'll give a Tay Show to, you know, three or four people who might show up. I'm pleasantly surprised that so many people are here right now. And considering that we've probably all got some sort of plan for the celebration of New Year's Eve. My plan, as it has been for the past few years, is to eat Chinese food and hope I can stay up till midnight and then go home. That wasn't always my celebration. I used to celebrate quite a bit wilder than that. And I remember when I was very young, I was always going to my Aunt Claire's house, Aunt Claire's for New Year's, and we'd get to stay up till midnight. Give us all the soda we'd want, and we'd be all sugared up and stay up till midnight. And I think back now, and you know, all those grown-ups who had that party were all younger then than I am now, and now most of them are dead. You know, but celebration goes on. I guess you only get so many New Year's. And, you know, New Year's is a funny thing, too. It's very arbitrary. You know, it's a tradition. It's the Western New Year. It's not the Chinese New Year. It's not a Lunar New Year. It's not the beginning of the Muslim calendar. It's just New Year, I guess. We win by popular vote. But my daughter and her friends are celebrating New Year in Bali. And by my estimation, it's already 2012 in Bali, so I'm sure their party is in full swing. I mean, but you know, the time aspect of it, just time in general. You know, we practice with time. We practice well. We sit in 25-minute periods and hope we can get through it. And, you know, maybe if we're feeling good, we won't take a break and we'll go through the hour period. There's always a time. There's always a time. You know, and there's that time when our legs really hurt, and there's a time where things seem to be going very smoothly. But there's always only just the moment. You know? you've ever been, and we all have been in this situation, of being about 5 minutes into a sit and all of a sudden our knees are just screaming and we know we're not going to move, and you have that choice. You know, am I in agony, or do I focus more on the breath? Focus more on the breath. Blow against the pain, blow the breath, and just to be in that moment. You know, the pain in the moment is never that bad. I found that what hurts most is thinking that this pain's not going to go away. The pain I'm feeling right now, well, that's, oh, it's going to be 20 minutes like that. And now all of a sudden, instead of dealing with the actual moment, you're dealing with the idea of 20 minutes of pain. Oh my God, what am I doing? Oh, now it's going to be an hour of pain. No, it's just a moment. You know, thinking of the New Year's Eve celebration, when I was thinking of all the people who have passed on, you know, people who no longer celebrate New Year's as they no longer walk the earth, people who are just starting to celebrate New Year's because it reminds me, there was a story by an Argentinian author, Borges, master of the short story. Some of his stories were maybe 2 or 3 pages long at most. And he had a story once, I'm not going to be able to recall all the detail, but the gist of it was there was a card game that went on in the neighborhood. And the men would gather, and they would play this card game. And one guy would die, and another guy would take his place. The card game was going on and on for years and years and years. And the gist of the story was that the players did not have the same reality as the card game. The card game existed, and the players just came and went. Which reminds me of, you know, New Year's Eve celebrations. Times Square filled with 500,000 people. You know, you look back to newsreel footage from the 40s, same scene. All those people are gone. All new people are in their place. You know, is this impermanence? Is this the idea of impermanence? Perhaps. Perhaps not. You know, time is a very funny thing. You know, a few years back, probably more than a few, there was an article of Discover magazine that was entirely devoted to time. Latest research on time, latest scientific thought on time. And it was a while ago, so this could all be changed by now. But the general consensus and the general feeling was that the more they examined it, the less time actually existed. That it really didn't have the substance of, say, a piece of wood or a glass of water, where you could examine molecules and, you know, tear it apart and find its substance. All you could do with time was build machines to measure your idea of time. That time itself had no actual reality. And in Zen practice, you know, we find that to be true. The more we practice, the more we practice. All right. By that I mean, we sit down and we count our breath in an effort to focus on being in this moment. But that's not, you know, that's not an arbitrary thing. The past doesn't exist. The future is unknown. I mean, we plan for certain things, but the future doesn't exist. All that ever exists for us is this moment. So focusing in this moment isn't just an arbitrary mental habit in order to develop our powers of focusing our mind. Focusing in this moment is also the only way to get deeply, deeply into the real. real fundamental nature, the real fundamental existence, non-existence, it's all in this moment. And so we take the time, we make the time, we sit, we follow our breath, and our thoughts dance around. They always get away from us. You know, what are we going to do? Where should we go for lunch? You know, did I turn off the oven? You know, your mind goes back and forth in time, but it's not going anywhere. It's just having thoughts. And some would say they're not even your thoughts. They're just thoughts. And the more we sit, the more we practice with our breath, the more clear it can become that this moment is the given. It is the all. Sharon, posted on Facebook this great thing. It's a timeline of a scale of the universe thing. You know, it kind of starts with men, and if you slide it, you move the slider this way, it gets smaller and smaller to molecules and light waves and subatomic particles and the things they're made of and the things they're made of to like this theoretical limit of tininess. And the other way goes up, you know, planets, solar systems, galaxies, universe, to this postulated all we can know, 14 billion light year wide. You know, I was looking at that, and it's a lot of fun. You go back and forth. You get some relative perspective. But thinking of it in terms of time and the actual unreal nature of time, when you bring this slide and you look at men, here's a guy. Here's a woman. He's got 45 minutes to get to work. He's going to work for 2 hours. Then there's going to be a meeting at about 10 o'clock. Hopefully they can get a 5-minute break after that. Hopefully they have enough time to finish up the meeting, get to lunch by noon, pick up their kids by 3, and this is how your day goes. It's time. Everything's time. Everything's time. If you move that slide just a little to this side, well, there's still time. You can measure a heartbeat. You can measure the rate at which cells are replicating. You can measure the rate at which a cancer may be growing. If you move it up the other end to a bigger picture, you can look down from your office and now you can see hundreds of people in traffic. And they're all working in time. The traffic lights are coming up in time. These people are moving. These people are crossing the street. Everybody's functioning in time. Even from an orbital perch, you know, if you're in this space station, in a space shuttle, you know, you'd see the Earth turning, you'd see the lights come on the dark parts of the planet. They put in light, and you see the lights go off again, and you have this sense of time. But as I was thinking of it, once you move smaller than molecular and atomic level, and larger than a planetary level, where does time go? Where does time go? Certainly when we get to the end, where there's this ultimate, all we can know picture of the universe, this almost theoretical thing, oh, there's no time there. I mean, I don't have the scientific theorems, but I think if you follow my feeling, there's really no time there. And at the lowest subatomic fabric of the universe, theoretical tininess, what does time mean? What can there be that would be time? Time is really only a very small concept that tends to surround the human mind and the human consciousness. Right? And it can be a source of great disturbance. You know? People, you know, most of the people in this room I've been practicing with quite a while. And you know, they have an idea of what I'm speaking of. But when you first start to practice, you find that your mind is so filled with not only what am I going to do when I get out of this room and I can uncross my legs? Oh, I'm going to have lunch. I'm going to take a walk. It's a beautiful day. But, you know, worrying about the future, still upset about the past, so much of your mind's activity is spent on things that have no substance, that have no reality. We try to, that's why we sit and we say, bring it back to the moment, bring it to your breath, bring your mind back to the present moment. Just keep bringing it back. It won't stay there. It'll run off. You just keep bringing it back. And the practice of bringing it back, slowly, slowly. And it's not an arbitrary thing. It's not just we picked the moment as a focus. The moment is where your life is happening. If you've ever been distracted and walked through a park to meet a friend, and you get to the other end, and the friend says, "Weren't those cherry blossoms beautiful?" And you realize you walked right past them because you were worried. You're planning something, you're worried something, you're upset about something. I mean, this is human nature. I mean, we have to be able to plan. We need to eat, so we need to figure out how to get the money, how to buy the food, how to get it in our bellies. So there's a certain need to it. The only problem comes up when we start to mistake that realm of time for our very real nature, which exists in the moment. So we practice. We keep coming back to the breath, to the moment. Now, a little over 2 weeks ago, I had a stroke. Now, that was a moment. I went out to walk the dog at about 9 o'clock at night. It's dark, and there were little footlights along the pathway. I started to see like bright-colored light happening off to my right-hand side. And then I noticed, and I thought something was in my eye, and then I noticed I couldn't see any street lights to my right-hand side. As I would turn my head, things would disappear. So I got back to the house and told my wife, I said, "Listen, something's wrong. I can't see off to my right-hand side." She said, "Let's go. We have to go to the hospital." So went down to Robert Wood Johnson, and they deduced right away it was a stroke. It was both eyes. I was having a field of vision problem. Took a quick CAT scan to make sure it wasn't a hemorrhage, and it said, "Well, we have to give you this drug, TPA, it's called. It's a powerful clot-busting drug. We know you're not bleeding, so it has to be a small clot, and we have to give you this drug now. In another hour, the window of opportunity for it to be effective will be over." No problem. Then they said, 6% of the people who get this develop a brain hemorrhage, and half of those people die. Okay, so now it's more than a blind spot. You know, now it's a little more. And I was oddly calm about it. I look on my wife's face, she was terrified. She was just terrified. I was of the mind that there wasn't much of a choice. Luckily, we have a top neurologist in the family out on the West Coast. So a few quick phone calls, and Andy reassured her that this is what we have to do. This is what we have to do. So I had the drip. Obviously, I didn't die. I didn't have a brain hemorrhage. I still have a little vision loss on the right-hand side, but after 4 days in intensive care and a full workup, they did find a small abnormality in my heart, but all my arteries are clear, my vein, my carotid artery is clear, my heart, echocardiogram, transesophageal. I check out pretty well. But that moment, when it was like, we have to do this and it could kill you, was one of those ones that sort of sticks with you. And I was calm about it, and it takes an hour to have the drug administered, but then they put you in ICU, and they watch you. I mean, I had all the monitors every half an hour, my blood pressure cuff was going off. There wasn't much sleep to be had that night. And the next morning, I managed to crank the bed up, and I'm looking out at the, we were facing Somerset Street, so I'm looking out over just the rooftops of the old New Brunswick, and I started feeling really bad. I'm almost 60. I'm here in this hospital gown. I've had a stroke. I'm hooked up to all these machines. I'm looking out over the tops of all these houses. There's no leaves on the trees. It's December. I could die. You know, I could die. I had a stroke. I could have another one. You know, it happens just like that. Just like that. In one moment, everything's changing. Now, I didn't stay in that self-pitying state very long. I managed to, you know, get myself out of it. I mean, I have been doing Zazen for a number of years. You know, there's Pema Chodron has a book, I might get the title wrong, but being comfortable with the places that scare you. Well, this was a great opportunity for me. You know, it was a very scary place. You know, the more they didn't find wrong with me, the more it became like, it just came out of the blue. It just came out of the blue. It could come again. Well, but you sit with that. And it is very uncomfortable. But at the same point, I realize that this is what practice should be, is what I was going to say. But you know, obviously I don't advocate trying to induce a stroke. But having lived through that part of, you know, you could die any minute. You know, the fact of the matter is that's always true. And it's always going to be true for as long as we walk this earth. Any breath could be our last. You know, and it seemed very profound at the time. This was 2 weeks ago. And in the course of 2 weeks, I've managed to, you know, get my insulation back on like we all have, where that's now just, you know, kind of a concept. You know, yes, he's right. Oh, yes, we could die at any time. Good. What's for lunch? You know? But in that moment, when you're hooked up to the monitors and they're watching you to see if, you know, just to make sure you don't develop a cerebral hemorrhage, you know, it's a little more to the front. It's a little more, not real, just a little more present. It's always real. It's just not always present. And in a sense, this is our practice. You know, we come to the moment. You know, not just from this theoretical that time doesn't exist. The moment is all we have. You know, this moment might be the moment when your brain starts to bleed. This might be the moment when you wake up. This might be the moment where for no reason your legs stop hurting. But this is the moment. You know, and we're always... You know, something brings us to the cushion. A lot of times it's you know, a general dissatisfaction with how life is. We think there's got to be something more. You know, we hear about it from our friend. We see a friend of ours. We know he does meditation. He seems pretty calm. He seems, you know, things don't tend to bother this guy. Things don't bother her so much as she bothers us. Maybe we should look into this. There are a lot of reasons. But there's usually some turning point that we sit down, we give it a try. And for everybody in this room, I would say, something about it just clicks. we say, for whatever reason we start to sit, the reason we continue to sit is because it just makes sense. Somebody tells you, oh, your mind's going to fly all around the room. You won't be able to focus. You won't be able to count your breath paths too. You say, all right, yeah, let me try that. That turns out to be right. Well, wait a minute, there's something here. I can't count my breath paths too. But it can be done. Let me try this. And you know, there have been many people who come in and either Kurt or myself, and we'll say, you're new, you're here for the first time. We tell them how to sit, how to breathe, what to expect. And they sit through the evening, have some tea at the end, and you never see them again. Well, that's fine too, you know. It is, I mean, to me, it's for everybody, but it's not for everybody. For everyone in this room, it just made so much sense. I mean, that's why you don't see Zen people out on the corner handing out pamphlets, you know, trying to say, come on, you have to try this. You know, people come to it. You know, the traditional technique at the temples would be a person would show up to practice Zen, and they'd say, get out of here. And they'd come back again, and they'd go, oh, are you here again? I told you to get out of here. And if they come back a third time, they're like, oh, all right, sit down and be quiet. You know? That's not pretty much the opposite of, like, say, fundamental Christians, just to pick them out of a hat, or, you know, oh, come on, come to my church, do this. And not just Christians, you know. There's a certain spirit of, like, oh, I found this great thing. You have to come and try it. And people tend to come to Zen on their own, one by one. Unlike most traditional, Zen's 2,500 years old. Unlike many other religions, there's not a big family basis. You know, you're a Catholic or a Muslim or a Hindu because your parents were. Very few people are sitting here because their parents practice Zen. There might be a few, but I think my point is valid enough. So, we keep coming back to the moment. But there's a problem with the moment, too. Does anyone know what time it is?
It's almost a quarter.
Okay. Mine just says text message, so I can't get the time. The problem with the moment is where I hopefully will dovetail it back into this koan. You know, we come to the moment, say, well, now I've got Zen. I'm going to be free of the past. I'm going to be free of all my illusory thoughts about the future, about time. I'm going to be in the moment. I'm going to find the fundamental nature. I'm going to come to this unshakable, quiet spot. And with enough practice, you will. You know, but there's a reason that that's called the Cave of Tigers, or the Ghost Cave. You know? A monk asked Dai Zui, when the Kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it, it's in quotes, will it perish or will it not perish? And by it, he means, you know, existence, this great mind, this great eternal oneness. So he said, it will perish. Well, now there's a problem. You know, we come to Zen, and we practice, and we focus into the moment, and we can let our concepts drop away of past and future, and our worries and our plans. Now we have this moment. But we want it to be everlasting. Dai Zui says, no. this too shall pass. Just like the card game that exists even as the players die and are replaced by other people, even as the New Year's Eve celebration goes on, despite the fact that the cast members are different each year, cast members are different. As we said, is someday the card game will be gone. Someday New Year's Eve will be gone. I think somebody once asked the Dalai Lama, you know, was he concerned that the human race might annihilate itself either through violence or pollution? And his response was something like, everything comes to an end. This is as natural for us as planning for the future or worrying about the past. We come to Zen for a lot of reasons, but one of them is what you would call the vision quest. We want to find that something greater. We want to find that something that, you know, transcends our small self, hooks us into this larger self, and is solid. And dare we say it, eternal. Now this koan. Now when we discuss koans, I remember once being doing a weekend retreat at Zen Mountain Monastery. It was Zazen, beautiful hall, perfectly quiet. One of the monitors, without any provocation or introduction, "There's no bottom." What? Funny thing is, it made sense, you know. There's no bottom to this swimming pool. You know? Don't look for a place to rest. There's no bottom. And these talks, these Dharma talks, are kind of like nice swimming pools. You know, you can dive in, and there's a discussion, and there's a perspective, and there's encouragement. There's a few laughs. It's like this swimming pool. But there's no bottom. There's no bottom. And as you do koan study, there's no bottom. As you do koan study, there's not only no bottom, there's no edges to this swimming pool. And there's no water. You know, talking about koans in Taisho is like the very superficial. It's like that swimming pool. It's a very superficial. When you work with a koan, you sit, you follow your breath, you enter a mushin, a deep mushin, and then you call to mind a koan, a turning word, a phrase from the koan, and you work with that. Something will come up. Something will come up. It's not the answer to the koan. Your koan is one hand clapping. You don't sit there and all of a sudden think. You know, it's not about a problem or a question. But at this level, what's this koan say? So we said it will perish. The monk asked, "Well, then, will it be gone with the other?" So he says, "It will be gone with the other." So it wasn't good enough for this guy. He had to ask the question twice. He didn't like what he heard the first time. You know? And we don't necessarily like it either. You know, we put a lot of effort in here, you know. Zen practice is a very funny thing. You know? We develop a strong desire to be free of desires. We make it our goal to have no goal. We want to see impermanence, but we want it to be a permanent vision. So, you know, without being redundant, and although I realize I'm preaching to the choir, what do you do in the face of this? What do you do in the face of it will perish? You come back to the moment. Not because it's a safe haven or a special place. It's because it's all you have. It's all any of us have at any given time is the moment. And the privilege that people in this room, I think, all feel that we have been given to learn how to breathe into that moment, how to do zazen, how to keep practicing. And it's always a practice, you know? It's never turning on a switch and you got it. No. So the Dalai Lama meditates for 3 hours a day. Now, if anybody should have it together by now. But it's not. It's the practice. In the notes to this, there's a funny story in the notes to this koan. And it's kind of a legendary thing. You know, the guy asks, monk asks Daisui, when the kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it perish? Or will it not perish? Now, obviously, he wants to hear, don't worry, no matter what happens to the universe, we got it. You and me, we've got this. So he said, it will perish. And the monk says again, then will it be gone with the other? So he said, yes, it'll be gone. It's gone. It's just over. When it's over, it's over. And in the notes, there's a story which is, they say, is probably not entirely true. He said, after he heard that, apparently he went to this, he went to Tosu, another Zen teacher, and told him what Daisui said. And Tosu listened to the story, and then he offered incense towards Daisui and said, another holy one has appeared in Sichuan. He praised Daisui for his answer. He says, go back to him now, confess your error, and follow his instruction. So the monk goes back to Daisui, according to this legend. When he gets back there, he finds out he's already dead. So he goes back to the second teacher, according to the legend, and now the second teacher is dead. So, you know, he asked the question twice, and he got it answered like 3 or 4 times. Monk asks Daisui, when the kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it perish or will it not perish? So he said, it will perish. The monk said, then will it be gone with the other? So he said, yeah, it'll be gone with the other. Secho's verse. Blocked by the double barrier, the monk asked from the heart of the kalpa fire, wonderful words, it will be gone with the other. Thousands of miles he wandered in vain, seeking a master.